Streaming live from Dazzle at Bowers on Tuesday, May 11th at 6:30 p.m., The Holly chronicles decades of race relations and activism and thwarted activism, and generally a story that has been suppressed from the invisible side of the growth in Denver. More information at dazzledenver.com/livestreams. This is the community calendar for Thursday morning, May 6, 2021. KILI Radio 90.1 is an independent, Lakota-owned, and operated 100,000-watt FM radio station located at Porcupine Butte on the Pine Ridge Reservation in southwestern South Dakota. Go to KILIRadio.org to learn more and to help support this radio station.
Support comes from Centennial Peaks Hospital, offering help for listeners or their loved ones who may be experiencing a mental health crisis. Inpatient and outpatient services available from a medical staff of independent practitioners. ECT available for treatment-resistant conditions.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has told Russia to cease what he called reckless and aggressive actions towards Ukraine. Speaking after talks in Kiev, Mr. Blinken said Russia had withdrawn some forces from the border, but significant numbers remained, a situation the U.S. was monitoring very closely. Mr. Blinken said that wasn't the only threat to Ukraine.
Ukraine faces twin challenges: aggression from outside coming from Russia, and in effect, aggression from within, coming from corruption, oligarchs, and others who are putting their interests ahead of those of the Ukrainian people. And these two things are linked because Russia also plays on that internal aggression, using corruption and using individuals to try to advance its interests as opposed to those of the Ukrainian people.
A Ugandan former child soldier who became a commander of the Rebel Lords Resistance Army has been sentenced to 25 years in jail by the International Criminal Court. Dominic Ongwen was convicted in February of more than 60 crimes, including murder, torture, rape and sexual enslavement. Anna Holligan reports from The Hague.
Dominic Ongwen was a child, like many in the LRA, forced to grow up groomed in the image of his oppressors. He was abducted aged 9 on his way to school in northern Uganda. The boy, nicknamed White Ant, rose rapidly through the rebel ranks. The 61 charges he was convicted of relate to attacks on 4 camps set up to protect those forced to flee their homes. Despite the gravity of the crimes and Dominic Ongwen's central role in committing them, the judges decided against the maximum life sentence because of the unique circumstances of his early life.
The government of Malawi has ordered thousands of refugees who have integrated into society to move to the country's only refugee camp. Some have lived in Malawi for years, setting up businesses and marrying Malawians. The authorities said one reason for the decision was the rise of violent jihadism in neighbouring Mozambique. The public prosecutor in Qatar has ordered the arrest of the finance minister, Ali Sharif Al-Ahmadi. The state news agency said he was detained for questioning over allegations of embezzlement and abuse of power. Mr. Al-Mahdi has been finance minister since 2013. Our Arab Affairs editor is Sebastian Usher.
The terse statement issued by the Qatari state news agency says that the decision to arrest Ali Sharif Al-Ahmadi was taken after a review of documents regarding crimes related to the public sector. He's believed to have played a key role in the rapprochement this year between Qatar and its Gulf neighbours after a long and damaging dispute. There had recently been speculation, though, that he might have fallen out of favour, as he was removed as chairman of the Qatar Financial Centre, which plays a key role in foreign investment in the country.
BBC News. Afghan officials say gunmen have shot dead a finance ministry employee and former television news anchor in the city of Kandahar. It's the latest in a spate of targeted killings. Nimyat Rawan was until recently a popular talk show host at Tolo News, Afghanistan's largest television network. No group has admitted responsibility. Somalia says it has restored diplomatic ties with Kenya after severing them in December. It accuses its neighbour of meddling in domestic politics ahead of elections which have now been postponed. Relations between the two countries are often stormy. They've been engaged in a maritime dispute for years, with both sides claiming potentially oil-rich waters. Dozens of French fishing boats have ended a short protest over fishing rights in the waters around the self-governing British Channel island of Jersey. France sent 2 patrol boats to the area, mirroring the dispatch of 2 British Royal Navy ships to Jersey overnight. The French fishermen are angry about new post-Brexit licences to work in Jersey's waters. Freddie Miller, BBC Radio Jersey's political reporter, watched the vessels gathering early this morning.
At 6:30, the boats all, one by one, entered the harbour. French flags flying, we could hear music. Red and orange flares were set off and they were burning against this very dark and misty sky. And the French boats came into the harbour, spent around 45 minutes circling the harbour, while people from Jersey stood where I am right now, looking down on the water, waving Jersey flags. After 45 minutes, the French boats turned, left the harbour. They spent much of the rest of the morning positioned just outside the harbour.
Russia's health ministry has authorised a single-shot version of the local Sputnik V vaccine. Phase 3 trials of Sputnik Light involved 4,000 volunteers across Russia. Officials say it's nearly 80% effective against COVID and costs less than $10 a dose. BBC News.
This is KGN News Morning Magazine for Thursday, May 6th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll take a look at a bill before the Colorado General Assembly that seeks to limit the amount of time arrestees can be held without a bond hearing. It's been 2 years since Denver voters approved a ballot measure to decriminalize psilocybin mushrooms. An expert panel convened to analyze the public health and safety impacts is expected to present its recommendations in coming weeks. We'll hear from one of its members. And we'll also hear about the non-hallucinogenic kinds of mushrooms in today's weekly food segment. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines, and then Kim Mooney, president of Practical Dying LLC, an educational group providing general and specific resources around end-of-life and grief to organizations and individuals, will be co-hosting a program with Sam Fuqua. Guests will be Dr. Jean Abbott, an emergency medicine physician and ethicist, and Rita Hayes, a program specialist with Telegen. Then at 9:30, a mix of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. And now, the headlines. Boulder County residents will be under a mask order for an additional 30 days as the Public Health Department continues to monitor rates of COVID-19 cases, vaccinations, and hospitalizations. On Wednesday, Boulder County Public Health Acting Executive Director Lexi Nolan said the extended order is meant to protect those who are not yet vaccinated, including children. It aligns with the updated state protocol as well as Jefferson County's requirements. The extended order requires that people wear masks at indoor public settings regardless of their vaccination status. And all businesses must continue to post signs at entrances instructing individuals to wear masks upon entry. More changes coming due to COVID, as Colorado lawmakers consider a bill that will require insurers to cover annual mental health wellness exams. Colorado would be paving the way for the rest of the nation should it pass. According to sponsors, the bill is an attempt to treat mental health like physical health, especially because COVID-19 has exacerbated mental health issues for many in the state. The mandate would take effect in 2022 and cover about 650,000 Coloradans. Meanwhile, a new report shows new businesses are trying to get a foothold in Colorado based on filings with the state. But the rate of unemployment is still a challenge as Colorado tries to recover from COVID-19. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
In a report released yesterday by CU Boulder and Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold, Colorado is building momentum towards making a full job recovery from the recession by 2022. But many Coloradans are still in need of jobs due to the pandemic. The latest report shows a record 44,000 new corporations, nonprofits, and other entities filed initial documents with the Colorado Secretary of State's office in the first quarter of 2021. This is a 29% increase of the previous quarter. Many industries have rebounded well from the recession, but the leisure and hospitality sector faces challenges, with 46% of jobs lost last year. CU Boulder's Leads of Business Research Division is projecting Colorado will add 90,000 jobs this year with continued growth into 2022. Colorado's labor force growth ranked first in the country, and the state's per capita personal income is 10th highest. But Colorado's unemployment rate is 0.4 percentage points higher than the national unemployment rate of 6%. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
A settlement has been reached in a lawsuit filed by the state of Colorado against the U.S. Department of Justice over immigration enforcement requirements. Colorado and several other states are set to have funding reinstated after the Biden administration repealed a policy that requires states to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement in order to receive funds. The action ends a dispute regarding $2.7 million in federal law enforcement funding withheld by the Trump administration over immigration enforcement requirements that began in early 2019. Colorado sued the federal government, and in April of 2020, a federal court sided with the state, ruling that the DOJ overstepped its bounds. But the Trump administration appealed the case. Now, the Department of Justice has dropped it. Colorado's governor says by 2023, the state will offer universal pre-kindergarten. That will include creating a Department of Early Childhood with the goal to improve the state's ability to consolidate funding and offer easier, centralized access to resources for parents. Florida, Vermont, and the District of Columbia currently offer free universal pre-K. At the same time, President Joe Biden has proposed taking the initiative nationwide with $200 billion to fund universal early childhood education for all students for the 2 years before kindergarten. Colorado plans to get the program off the ground by using money from a tax on vaping products passed by voters in 2020. Under the state's plan, by the start of the 2023-2024 school year, every family in Colorado will have access to at least 10 hours a week of pre-K per child if they want. The state already has a universal kindergarten program, which passed in 2019. Finally, a virtual graduation ceremony will be held at noon today for the University of Colorado Boulder's graduates. During the ceremony, CU Boulder will confer 9,300 undergraduate and graduate degrees from fall 2020 and spring and summer 2021. The forecast for the Front Range today, sunny skies predicted with a high around 70 degrees and a low of 50 tonight. Early 80 tomorrow, but cloudy skies and rain expected by Saturday and expected to stay around through Tuesday of next week with high temperatures around 50. Right now, outside our Boulder studios, it's 42 degrees. Legislation to reform Colorado's pre-trial detention system is once again under consideration. House Bill 1280 requires a court to hold a bond-setting hearing within 48 hours of the processing of an arrest. Representative Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez is one of the bill's co-sponsors.
House Bill 1280 upholds the principle that all are innocent until proven guilty. I want us to keep in mind today that over half of the people in our jails are presumptively innocent. They have not been convicted of a crime. Some people, mostly those arrested on a Friday or Saturday, can sit in jail for days before they get their first hearing before a judge, and that hearing is the bond hearing.
The state's current system can sometimes result in lengthy pretrial detentions in the event of weekend arrest or when a resident of one county is detained in another. Tristan Gorman is a Denver-based criminal defense attorney.
We who practice indigent defense have seen for years and years that the presumption of innocence really is only a reality for those with the financial means to post monetary bond. And even in those cases, it depends entirely on how long it takes someone to be brought before a judge to have a bond set. There are numerous jurisdictions that will set a no bond hold on a warrant. And we have seen many cases where someone is arrested out of county and held in a hub jurisdiction such as Denver for typically 10 to 14 days before they are transported for a bond hearing.
Prolonged pretrial detention can result in job loss and other steep financial consequences. Even prosecutors seem to agree that reform is necessary. William Culver was one of six Colorado district attorneys who testified before the state's House Judiciary Committee yesterday.
I would say that all of us are certainly in favor of shortening the time frame for which a bond is set on crimes of domestic violence, crimes which are violent crimes, where the court does not set bond immediately. All of us are in favor of that. None of us are in favor of people losing their job on Monday morning. But none of us, with our present staffing levels and our present financial burdens, are able to just absorb this cost in small counties. It's just not possible for us.
The district attorneys say passing HB 1280 without fiscal support for increased staffing hours amounts to unpaid overtime. But with adequate funding, they would support it. They estimate it would cost $950,000 to keep the state's DA's offices staffed and operational over the weekends. The House Judiciary Committee approved HB 1280 yesterday. It now heads to appropriations. You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Years ago, Denver voters passed a ballot measure to decriminalize the possession, cultivation, and storage of psilocybin mushrooms for personal use. As a result of the ordinance, the city's government convened a panel to study its public health and safety impacts and to make policy recommendations. The Denver Psilocybin Mushroom Policy Review Panel is the first of its kind and is expected to present its recommendations in the coming weeks. KGNU's Remy Kachadurian spoke with panel member attorney Sean McAllister.
The panel includes District Attorney Beth McCann. It includes one of the deputy chiefs of the Denver Police Department, a representative of the Denver Sheriff's Department, the city attorney's office. So this is a broad-based stakeholders group that's been assessing the impact of the psilocybin decriminalization in Denver. And we've had an amazing year of meetings, and we've seen that nothing has really changed in Denver. There have been no major public health impacts. There's no major incidents of somebody being intoxicated on psilocybin in public, no public safety problems associated with the decriminalization. And so the big picture umbrella conclusion is that the sky hasn't fallen in Denver. Essentially, nothing has changed. And that there might be some reasons to consider expanding the law. Denver was the first city in America to decriminalize psilocybin, but quickly thereafter, Oakland, Santa Cruz, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Washington, D.C., all these other cities have followed our lead and also decriminalized not just psilocybin, but also other psychedelics. And they've decriminalized not just the possession for personal use of these substances, but they've also decriminalized the social sharing. They've talked about protecting the healing ceremonies. So actually, these recommendations would really just bring Denver in line with the broader progressive reforms that are happening in other cities.
What are the discussions at the state level? Is there any chance we can see it decriminalized at the state level? We've seen Oregon in the past few months decriminalizing all psychedelics.
There were lobbyists and activists that were talking to legislators this year about a bill, but it looks like it's not going to happen. We're at the end of the session and it hasn't been introduced, and there's not a lot of consensus about what that should look like between the legislators and the activists. So there is not going to be anything in the legislature. What's happening simultaneously at the state level around the country, as you mentioned, Oregon has established a hybrid model of medicalization and adult use for psilocybin. Essentially, what the Oregon model says is as long as there is some state licensed person to distribute the psilocybin to you, you don't have to have a specific diagnosed condition, but you can go use it for therapeutic or personal exploration or to address a mental health issue, but it's not really a medical model because you don't have to have a specific diagnosis. Anyone over 21 in Oregon in about 2 years, assuming the feds don't interfere, will be able to walk in, obtain psilocybin, and use it on site in a treatment center, and then go home once the effects wear off. So the Oregon model is coming. And in the meantime, California has introduced a law to decriminalize all psychedelics. And that law is making progress, and it's passed two state Senate committees. And so that's the context with which activists are looking at all this and saying, you know, we should consider a ballot initiative in 2022 in Colorado if the legislature won't do the right thing. And so I think you're going to begin seeing a lot of discussion in the next 18 months in Colorado about whether we're ready to decriminalize psilocybin. And I think we are. I think voters know the drug war is a failure. This is why Denver voters voted in favor of this. The momentum is gaining. People see that this has not been a problem in cities like Denver. And we're very hopeful that the Colorado voters, if we make it to the ballot, will agree. And in the meantime, the legislature should step in and do the right thing. But if they don't, I think activists will be going to the ballot.
And what about at the federal level? Are there any initiatives in the Congress to decriminalize psilocybin?
As I mentioned, the activists in Washington, D.C. passed a local decriminalization initiative, and they have since formed a group called the Plant Medicine Coalition with the specific intent of bringing together activists to influence federal legislation. And so there was a bill by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez last year that would have allowed research into the medical benefits of psychedelics and psilocybin in particular. That bill didn't go anywhere last year, but there's hope that that can be reintroduced this year. You know, there's a lot of constituents that would benefit from this research and expanded access to psilocybin, including veterans, people with a history of trauma and severe mental illness. And so there's a belief that there certainly is a constituency in Congress to help veterans, to address the mental health crisis. And we ultimately need federal level changes, because it is true that no matter what a city does, no matter what a state does, as long as it's still illegal at the federal level, we're going to have issues. And you see that in cannabis that lives in this quasi-legal world. And the only alternative to some reform will be a pharmaceutical route. And the pharmaceutical route is coming in the next 2 to 3 years. Psilocybin's in clinical trials now, so is MDMA. Ketamine is currently legal to be prescribed for mental health conditions. So within the next 2 to 3 or 5 years at the max, we're going to see psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine as federally approved psychedelic drugs. So there will be an avenue there, but it's going to be the same health inequities that we have in America with everything else. It's going to be an expensive therapy. You're going to have a specialist who knows how to do psychedelic-assisted therapy. You know, most health insurance plans cover mental health very poorly, and so you can expect potentially very high expenses for these prescription drugs. And so that is one model in the future, that some people will have access to psilocybin therapy through prescription drugs, but it's going to be a very narrow group of people. It's going to be a very expensive therapy. And so the only way to make psilocybin broadly available will be through these state-regulated, state reform models that allow home grow. And so my point is, all those things will take the tolerance or a change in federal law to allow that to happen.
For KGNU, I'm Remy Gachadurian.
Now for a report on mushrooms that are not hallucinogenic. Radio Nibbles is on an indefinite sabbatical, but in the meantime, we continue to bring you food segments on Thursdays. This week, we look at Hazel Deli Mushrooms, a family-run organic mushroom farm based in Fort Collins. They produce exotic varieties like black trumpet, cinnamon cap, crimini, golden oyster, lion's mane, royal trumpet, shiitake, pink oyster, and piopino. KGNU's Rosana Longo caught up with the farm's Jim Gauss as he was wrapping up the sales at the farmer's market in Boulder.
I'm here at the farmer's market. I have in front of me Hazel Deli mushrooms, and as always, they are going fast. How do you see your business going?
The business is really booming right now. We've just opened up into Sprouts. We're in most of the restaurants around here. People are very innovative with the way that they use the mushrooms and creating new dishes such as crab cakes, scallops, tacos.
Tell me, what's unique about your product?
Well, we've been around for 40 years. We cultivate all of these ourselves in light and climate-controlled shipping containers and buildings. Jim Hammond, that started the business, it was very committed to having a quality product. Jim's no longer with us now, and Jared is owning the farm now and is doing a fantastic job. We've made an addition to the farm. We have a farm store now, and it's where our processing is as well. And so you can go there from 8 to 4 during the week to buy mushrooms if you can't make it to the farmer's market or one of the local grocery stores.
There's something particular about mushrooms that is how healthy they are for you.
Mushrooms are a meat alternative. They do have protein. Shiitake mushrooms are really good for the immune system. Lion's mane, I'm sure most people have already heard about lion's mane. It's great for all neurological disorders. They're using it for people with memory loss, Alzheimer's, head injuries, neuropathy, nerve damage, and not to mention it's great tasting. But all the mushrooms are good and all very good for you.
Is there something I'm not asking you that is important in the world of mushrooms?
Oh gosh, well, just talking about the recipes, when I mention to people at the farmer's market if they've ever made crab cakes with it, it kind of blows their mind. And once they try it and they come back, they said it's amazing how much it tastes like a crab cake. I think it's the recipes. You know, so many people are starting to do grows in their own homes with the grow kits that you can buy now. So everyone's aware of mushrooms, and it makes us feel good because we were the first at the Boulder Farmers Market, and now there are two more vendors here that have mushrooms as well. So it's really taken off, and people are really recognizing the health benefits and the alternative to meat product that mushrooms are.
People are starting to grow their own mushrooms at home.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I think it's great. You know, I think that it became possible, or more, they're more aware of the possibility of it once you realize that you could start growing microgreens in your own home. And so if you've got the space, it's a great hobby. It's fun to do.
Is there something else that you will recommend, like, for example, a recipe, an easy recipe to do, especially with the mushrooms that you are selling today? They uh-huh. look gorgeous.
I'm going to tell you a recipe with the lion's mane powder. When we dehydrate the lion's mane and then we just grind it to a powder, it's a 2-ounce bag, and you can put the powder in a crock pot or on the stove, but with 6 to 8 cups of water. You let it simmer for about 4 hours. All the nutrients of that lion's mane comes out. Then you just put it in a jar and put it in your refrigerator. You can add it to your coffees, your teas, your smoothies, your stews, and you get the health benefits even more so with it cooked like that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much
you.
For allowing me to interview you today. May I get your name?
My name's Jim.
So in other words, it's a family business.
It is. It is.
And it's a local family business.
It is.
Why is it important for all of us to support a local family-owned business?
Well, when you've got a product that really takes a lot of dedication and time and expense to get that quality product, it's here in the community. Why not buy from the community?
For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
Before we go, let's take a quick peek at what's coming up on tonight's It's the Economy with Liz Lane.
As the internal battle in the Republican Party rages, the party's traditional strong relationship with business has also come under stress in the wake of the November election, the January 6th insurrection, and more recently, states' efforts to pass legislation curtailing voting and voting access. This Thursday, May 6th at 6 p.m. on It's the Economy, we'll air a conversation with Yale School of Management Professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. He has hastily gathered scores of U.S. business CEOs following each of these events to discuss, strategize, and actually push back on these actions through boycotts and instituting freezes on political campaign donations. When did the cozy relationship between business and the GOP start to unravel? And what are the implications for our politics, the economy, and access to the ballot? That's this Thursday evening, May 6th at 6 p.m. on It's the Economy on KGNU Community Radio.
And that does it for today's program. You've been listening to The Morning Magazine here on listener-supported community radio. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for a special program with Kim Mooney on end-of-life and grief management. But first, a news update from the BBC.
Support comes from the CU Museum of Natural History in Boulder, currently offering a new virtual experience of their popular Paleontology Hall, plus fresh exhibits and do-it-yourself activities, available online in both English and Spanish. More information can be found at colorado.edu/CU Museum.
Support comes from Westward, presenting Westward's Feast to Go, a celebration of Denver's restaurant scene, one bite at a time. Thursday, May 13th from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Stanley Marketplace in Aurora. Tickets and information at westwardfeast.com.
Actions towards Ukraine. Speaking after talks in Kiev, Mr. Blinken said Russia had withdrawn some forces from its recent buildup along the border, but significant numbers remained. The Ugandan former commander of the Rebel Lords Resistance Army has been sentenced to 25 years in jail by the International Criminal Court. Dominic Ongwen was convicted in February of more than 60 crimes, including murder, torture and sexual enslavement. Judges refrained from giving him a life sentence because he was abducted and groomed by the rebels as a child. Malawi's government has ordered thousands of refugees who have integrated into society to move into an overcrowded camp. Many have resettled in Malawi and have married local people, but the government says they're a potential threat to national security. South Africa's governing party, the ANC, is in the grips of a growing power struggle over its attempt to suspend its Secretary-General, Ace Magashule, who faces a corruption trial. He's refused to accept the suspension, saying it flouts the ANC's constitution. In a reversal, he says he has now suspended the country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa. The public prosecutor in Qatar has ordered the arrest of the finance minister, Ali Sharif Al-Emadi. State media said he was being questioned over allegations of embezzlement, abuse of power and crimes related to the public sector. President Putin has signalled Russia's backing for a proposal to temporarily waive international patent protections for coronavirus vaccines. It comes a day after the US did the same. The makers of the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine have agreed to supply their jab to all athletes and delegations participating in the Tokyo Olympic and Paralympic Games. BBC News.
BBC News on listener-supported KGNU.
Welcome back to News.
8:32 in the morning. Hello, I'm Sam Fuqua, co-hosting this morning the program we do once per quarter with Kim Mooney. She's the president of Practically Dying, an educational group providing general and specific resources around end-of-life and grief to organizations and individuals. This morning, we're talking about Colorado healthcare ethics resources and what has been a powerful response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Kim, good morning. Good to see you on the online meeting platform.
Good morning, Sam. Nice to see you again, too.
And joining Kim this morning, Dr. Jean Abbott, a board-certified emergency medicine physician. She serves on the board of the University of Colorado Hospital Ethics Committee, as well as the True Hospice Ethics Committee. And also with us is Risa Hayes, a program specialist with Telegen. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent. Everybody connected and well. You know, when COVID hit Colorado, an unrecognized and eclectic group of over 150 healthcare professionals and ethicists from some 54 organizations came together in an innovative collaboration to advise our healthcare systems through the different crises the pandemic has caused. They work together with an integrated vision and meeting regularly created strategies and resources that are identifying the cracks in our current systems and influencing how we're supporting our most vulnerable populations. It's called the Colorado Healthcare Ethics Resources Group and contributing to this critical statewide conversation that might not have been recognized or addressed otherwise. Kim, let me start with you. You know, as we talk about death and dying and grief on these quarterly programs, what's the connection to this group?
Well, I would say there's been a lot of death and dying and grief in the pandemic, just to be simplistic. But let me say what I think this group has done, and I'll start this, just take a second. When we went through the AIDS crisis, President Bush said, we better be prepared for the next thing that happens. And as usual, we didn't get prepared. And in our last hostile administration, basically, when COVID hit, the president told everybody to go fish on their own. So each state was on their own to figure out how they were going to handle this. And so here's a couple of revolutionary ideas that we started with. They're very hard to understand. One is science is real. And the other one is the path of this disaster is continually unfolding. And all these turns are not failures or deceptions. We've required people who can think along the way. And that's what this group has been. They have dealt with the high drama situations at the beginning, you know, a nursing home is a death sentence, but they have put together, as I'm saying, probably the most important part is that they've come together as a community, which is what we need most when we are dealing with grief and death. And they have brought expertise and passion and responsiveness and creativity and hard truths and humor and the absolute reliance on each other to get things done. And that's, I think, a huge benefit to how we've managed dealing with, not only as we talked about in the last show, death, dying, and grief, but the moral distress and trauma. So sentence center, I just thought it was really important that people understood what happens down in the weeds.
Let me ask Dr. Jean Abbott. You know, everybody works in their own area of expertise. They have their own responsibility, their own practice. Why, in your view, is a collaboration like this essential?
Well, at a state level, which is, as Kim says, where a lot of disaster planning happens, there are national standards that have existed for the last many decades. But a state has to come together and a group of providers and institutions to try to have fair treatment of patients that is consistent over time. That's one of the ways that you keep trust with your community. And so every time a big disaster happens, disaster planning on a federal level and a state level gets tweaked. And that happened with HIV, as Kim says, with SARS, with Ebola. And sometimes the disasters are natural disasters, or like Haiti or Katrina. 9/11 was a big disaster. And every time they happen, we tweak the planning. But this was an unusual disaster, and it required thinking about things a little bit differently. There was the big morbidity and mortality. People were dying. This was a totally novel infection. We didn't know anything about it at the beginning. And it is a longitudinal disaster. It's not like one and done. This has been a rolling disaster now for what? 14 months, I guess, something like that. So coming together helps us all think better about how to approach the threats in a fair manner across the state, and also hear what's going on the Western Slope, where philosophies are different, politics are different, but most importantly, different parts of the disaster are happening at different times there than here.
Jean Abbott, from an ethical perspective, what were some of the major questions this group is wrestled with, still wrestling with, perhaps?
Well, when I am at the bedside as a doctor, I have a certain ethical standard that I put my patient first, that I respect them, honor them, and I prioritize and advocate for them. When we get into a public health crisis, this is a very stressful thing for clinicians, for nurses, for everybody in the hospital and in nursing homes and other institutions, because we no longer are allowed to prioritize just our patients. If I have a patient who needs a ventilator and my colleague has two that need a ventilator and somebody else has three and we only have two ventilators, all of a sudden, I can't push to the front of the line and say, my patient goes first. We have to sort out how we're going to fairly allocate something when it becomes in short supply.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to bring Risa Hayes into the conversation. Risa, we identified you as a program specialist with Telegen. I didn't explain what Telegen is. Can you do that for us?
I can. So there's a national program funded by the